Ayrım 20.
Sayfa 246. The end which Bradley lays down is that of finding my station and carrying out its duties. These duties will be specific and concrete. Bradley allows that I may have some choice of what station in life to fill. But once I have chosen some station, the question of what duties attach to it is not a matter of choice. That is, so is of some importance, for it is only in so far as the end is an objective end, and not one chosen by me, that I can hope to realize my individuality through it. What Bradley means by this is not entirely clear, but he is partly making the substantial point that any criteria by which I am to judge of my own moral progress must be criteria whose authority derives from something other than my own choices. For if my own choice is all that is authoritative, I am in the end playing an arbitrary self-enclosed game, a variety of spiritual patience, in which if the cards will not come out the first time, I can, if I choose, allow myself an indefinitely large number of reshufflings. Moreover, to fill my station in life, I can utilize every part of my nature. The Kantian divide between duty and inclination is overcome. What Bradley is presupposing rather than asserting here is that the moral vocabulary can only be given a coherent sense in the context of a form of social life with well-defined roles and functions, and one, moreover, in which men live out the substance of their lives in terms of those roles and functions. But is there such a society anymore? Sociologists have often emphasized the difference between a modern individualist society in which a man's life and status can be distinct from his various roles and functions, and earlier, more integrated forms of society in which a man might fill his station in life in much the way that Bradley envisages. That Bradley is able not to raise this type of question is perhaps due to his ability to pass into a metaphysical style of speech in which it is the nature of reality as such and nothing less that guarantees his thesis about morality. This is less true, but it is still true, of T.H. Green. Green is more self-consciously aware that his moral views require a certain kind of society. But his metaphysical mode enables him to pass from the view that society ought to be the locus of a rational general will of a Rousseauske kind to the view that, at bottom, this is what society really is. Green is more socially aware than Bradley because of his own political involvement. He came on the philosophical scene as an educator in a period when liberal young men of the ruling class, morally earnest as a result of their training in evangelical homes and by Arnoldian schoolmasters, who could not imbibe the romantic Toryism of Disraeli, were looking for a frame that would lend meaning to their lives. Green's Ballypole pupils carried into the civil service, the church, politics, into the cabinet itself, one of them was a liberal prime minister, a belief that liberal individualism could be overcome within a liberal framework. Green was the apostle of state intervention in matters of social welfare and of education. He was able to be so because he could see in the state an embodiment of that higher self, the realization of which is our moral aim. Green's prolegomena to ethics rests its argument on an extended analysis of human nature, designed to show that human existence is not wholly explicable in terms of the laws of nature. reflection on the purposive and self-conscious character of human existence reveals to us the awareness of ourselves as intelligent beings and members of a society of intelligent beings whose final satisfaction cannot be anything merely physical or perishable. What, then, is the human good? We know it only in part, because our faculties for realizing it are themselves only partly realized. But the contemporary moral consciousness is a record of our highest achievement of it to date. Kant was right in thinking that the one unconditional good is the goodwill, but wrong in his too abstract characterization of it. The goodwill is manifested in the desire to transcend the existing moral consciousness in the creation of a greater good, and every expression of the goodwill is the creation of a form of life specifiable along the lines of the Greek classification on the virtues. The goodwill is defined as the will to know what is true, to make what is beautiful, to endure pain and fear, to resist the allurements of pleasure in the interest of some form of human society. Green's specification of the good in terms of a form of social life, even if his own specification is a highly abstract one, enables him at least to avoid the individualist puzzles over egoism and altruism. The idea of a true good does not admit of the distinction between good for self and good for others, precisely because it consists of a form of social life in which different individuals play out their parts. The individual finds his good through a form of life which exists prior to himself. Yet, is Green describing at this point what actually happens? Clearly not. Is he specifying an ideal state of affairs which ought to be brought into existence? Only partly, for he believes the ideal to be implicit in the actual. Like Bradley, he makes it clear that the moral vocabulary cannot be understood except against the background of a certain kind of social life. Like Bradley, his metaphysical style enables him to evade the question of the relation between that form of social life and social life as it actually is lived out in 19th century Western Europe. But at least Bradley and Green force these questions upon us. Their immediate 20th century successors were to write as if morality, and with it, moral philosophy existed apart from all specific social forms. Chapter 18. Modern Moral Philosophy. Modern moral philosophy opens on a quietly apocalyptic note. Moral philosophers, it is explained, have hitherto failed to answer the questions which they pose satisfactorily because they have failed to be clear about the questions themselves. In particular, they have failed to distinguish between the questions, what kind of actions ought we to perform, and what kind of things ought to exist for their own sake. The distinction is made at last, or so it is proclaimed, in the preface to G. E. Moore's Principia Ethica. The implication is that the problems will now be solved. The date is 1903. The answer to the question, what kind of actions ought we to perform, is those which will cause more good to exist in the universe than any possible kind of alternative. We are thus brought to ask what states of affairs are good, what kind of things ought to exist for their own sake. Moore takes it that the things which ought to exist for their own sake are those which we call intrinsically good. How do we know what is intrinsically good? The answer is that we cannot fail to recognize the property of intrinsic goodness when confronted with it. Propositions concerning what is intrinsically good, as contrasted with what is good only because it is a means to something intrinsically good, are susceptible neither of proof nor of disproof. This is because good is the name of a simple, unanalyzable property, which Moore calls non-natural, because it cannot be identified with any natural property. Moore holds that good is indefinable, partly in virtue of an analogy, which he propounds between good and yellow, and partly by reason of an argument about the consequences of holding good to be definable. But both the analogy and the argument depend in part on the curious sense which he assigns to definition. To define, he holds, is to break up a complex whole into its constituent parts. So the definition of horse will be a statement to the effect that it has four legs, a head, a heart, a liver, etc., all of them arranged in definite relations to one another. Moore recognizes other senses of definition, but deliberately puts them on one side. Now, if this is what is meant by definition, it is not difficult to agree that good is indefinable, but this sense of definition is so idiosyncratic that nothing has been gained. Moore also tries to reinforce his case by an appeal to what we allegedly must recognize when we hold a given notion before our minds. He says that if we consider good and, let us say, pleasant, or any other notion with which we might be tempted to confuse good, we can see that we have two different notions before our minds. This technique of holding one's concepts up to the light, as it were, is reinforced by Moore's method of calm assertion. More unwarranted and unwarrantable assertions are perhaps made in Principia Ethica than in any other single book of moral philosophy, but they are made with such well-mannered, although slightly brow-beating certitude, that it seems almost gross to disagree. But what then is Moore's case? Moore originally rests his analogy between yellow and good on his notion of definition. Yellow and good, we say, are not complex. They are nations out of which definitions are composed and with which the power of further defining comes. Moreover, just as we cannot identify the meaning of yellow with the physical properties of the light which produces the effect of seeing yellow, so we cannot identify the meaning of good with the particular natural properties which are associated with good. It might be the case that anything good was pleasant, just as all yellow light is of a certain wavelength, but it does not follow that good means what pleasant means, any more than it follows that yellow means the same as light of a certain wavelength. Moore's one genuine argument is used to show that good cannot be the name of any complex whole. Of any such whole, however defined, we can always significantly ask whether it is itself good. This argument can be deployed not only against the attempt to define good as the name of a complex, but also against the attempt to define it at all. Suppose that I do identify good with pleasant. My mistake can be exhibited by showing that I can always significantly ask of pleasure or of anything pleasant, is it good? But if good named the same property that pleasant names, to ask, is what is pleasant good, would be equivalent to asking, is what is pleasant pleasant? That is, it would be vacuously tautologous. Moore frames this argument in order to refute hedonists, whom he conceives to hold two incompatible positions. They hold that pleasure is good, indeed the good, in a significant, non-tautological sense, and they claim to demonstrate this by urging that good means nothing other than what pleasant means. But the first position requires that pleasure is good be taken to be analytic. Yet it cannot be both. So the hedonist position collapses. But of course it only collapses for those hedonists unwise enough to attempt to hold both these positions. The philosophers whom Moore chiefly criticizes are J.S. Mill and Herbert Spencer. In the case of Mill, Moore's criticisms are misdirected, if only because he reads into Mill a definition of good as meaning pleasant, whereas all that Mill at the most says is that pleasure provides us with our only criterion of goodness. It is by now almost a commonplace to recognize that Moore misrepresented Mill. It is a measure of the extent to which contemporary philosophers read Mill, but do not read Spencer, that it goes unrecognized that Moore also misrepresented Spencer. Moore accuses Spencer of having thought that good meant the same as more evolved. Spencer's, however, was a far more complex, if quite implausible, position. Spencer held, first, that human society has evolved, just as the human species evolved, and indeed that the evolution of species and of society can be placed on a single continuous scale. Secondly, he believed that the higher a society is upon this scale, the more ideal its morality. And thirdly, that conduct tends more and more toward the end of preserving life, it being assumed that in life there is, especially as one ascends toward the ideal, more pleasure than pain. As with Mill, Spencer may, in unguarded moments, have given the impression that he was defining the moral vocabulary. But the real Herbert Spencer is as far from being Moore's straw man as is the real J.S. Mill. Footnote: See The Science of Ethics. To the doctrine that good was the name of a natural property, Moore gave the name the naturalistic fallacy. For Moore, this fallacy is committed in the course of any attempt to treat good as the name of a property identifiable under any other description. Good cannot mean commanded by God any more than it can mean pleasant, and for the same reasons the expression the naturalistic fallacy has since been adopted by the adherents of the view that one cannot logically derive an ought from an is, but although this latter doctrine is a consequence of Moore's, it is not identical with it. Is good, then, the name of a simple, unanalyzable property? To the doctrine that it is, there are at least two conclusive objections. The first is that we can only use the name of a simple property intelligibly where we are acquainted with some standard example of the property, by reference to which we are to recognize whether it is present or absent in other cases. In the case of a simple property like yellow, we can use standard examples of the color to recognize other cases of yellow. But how could having learned to recognize a good friend help us to recognize a good watch? Yet, if Moore is right, the same simple property is present in both cases. To this, a disciple of Moore might reply that we are confusing the question by our example. A good watch is not intrinsically good. But how then do we recognize the intrinsically good? The only answer Moore offers is that we just do. Or put this point another way. Moore's account could only reach the level of intelligibility if it were supplemented by an account of how the meaning of good is learned and an account of the relation between learning it in connection with some cases and knowing how to apply it in others. The second objection is that Moore's account leaves it entirely unexplained and inexplicable why some things being good should ever furnish us with a reason for action. The analogy with yellow is as much a difficulty for his thesis at this point as it is an aid to him elsewhere. One can imagine a connoisseur with a special taste for yellow objects to whom some things being yellow would furnish him with a reason for acquiring it. But some things being good can hardly be supposed to furnish a reason for action only to those with the connoisseur's interest in goodness. Any account of good that is to be adequate must connect it intimately with action and explain why to call something good is always to provide a reason for acting in respect of it in one way rather than another. That it does connect good with action is the chief virtue of the other seminal moral philosophy of the 20th century, that of John Dewey. For Dewey, the chief trap in all epistemology is the tendency to abstract our knowledge, both from the methods by which we acquired it and from the uses to which we may put it. We only acquired whatever knowledge we have now because we had certain purposes, and the point of that knowledge is for us inseparable from our future purposes. All reason is practical reason. Moral knowledge is not a separate branch of knowledge. It is simply the knowledge we have in physics, biology, history, or what you will, considered in relation to those purposes. To characterize something as good is to say that it will provide us with satisfaction in our purposes, as means or as end, as both. And Dewey is concerned to emphasize what he takes to be the interrelated character of good as a means and good as an end. We are as far as it is possible to be from Moore's concept of the intrinsically good with its sharp separation of means and ends. Dewey concentrates on the agent while Moore concentrates on the spectator. Dewey almost obliterates the distinction between fact and value, between is and ought, while Moore emphasizes it. Dewey thinks that in making choices we are guided by considerations which we express in statements of an ordinary empirical kind, statements which presuppose the direction of the agent's purposes and interests, but which do not differ from, which in fact are the statements of our empirical studies. That Dewey has not been more influential, particularly in England, is perhaps explicable by the fact that he so seldom attends explicitly to the problem which has been at the center of Anglo-Saxon moral philosophy in this century, that of the meaning of moral predicates, and where Dewey did exert a major influence, it was indirectly, in a discussion that stemmed from Moore. Moore's immediate heirs were of two kinds. There were those who carried on moral philosophy of the same type as Moore's, the so-called intuitionists, such as Pritchard, Ross, and Carrot. It ought to be emphasized both that these writers did not in fact acquire their views from Moore, but independently, and that the value of their writings is not only a matter of how cogently they presented their own views. Carrot, for example, will be remembered for his power as a critic of utilitarianism, as well as for his writings on aesthetics. This particular succession of writers was ushered in by a text as dramatic in its way as Principia Ethica, a paper by H. A. Pritchard in 1912 entitled Does Moral Philosophy Rest Upon a Mistake? Pritchard takes the task which moral philosophy has set itself to be that of providing a reason or justification for holding that something which we take to be our duty is indeed our duty. But he argues that the demand for such a reason or justification is utterly misconceived. In defense of this position, he offers in effect two sorts of reason. I may try to justify the view that something is my duty by showing that it is to my interest or would lead to my happiness. But if this is what provides me with a reason, then I am not treating whatever I take my duty to be as a duty at all. For what I do because it is to my interest, I thereby do not do as a duty. Or I may try to justify the view that something is my duty by showing that to perform it would be to produce some good. But, so Pritchard says, that something is good does not entail that it is obligatory on me to bring it about. This first kind of argument starts from a list of what Pritchard presumably takes to be the only possible types of allegorical justification. His second consists in appeals to that of which we are all alleged to be conscious. The apprehension of duty is said to be immediate and unquestionable, and therefore not to be supported by reasons. Pritchard's outstanding characteristic, and one which he shares with Moore as well as with other intuitionists, is the treatment of good, right, duty, obligatory, and the rest of the moral vocabulary as though it was a coinage of permanently fixed values and simple scrutiny. It is doubtless because of this that the proportion of assertion to argument is so high in Pritchard. In other intuitionist writers, such as Sir David Ross, who holds that we have independent intuitions of rightness and goodness, the standards of argument are much higher. But all intuitionist writers suffer from one difficulty. They are, on their own view, telling us only about what we all know already. That they sometimes disagree about what it is that we all know already only makes them less boring at the cost of making them even less convincing. The two most powerful critics of intuitionism were R. G. Collingwood and A. J. Ayer. Collingwood, whose attack extended to many other recent writers in ethics, attacked them for their lack of historical sense, for their tendency to treat Plato, Kant, and themselves as contributors to a single discussion with a single subject matter and a permanent and unchanging vocabulary. They are, he says in his autobiography, like men who translate the Greek word trieres by steamship, and when it is pointed out to them that the characteristics which Greek writers assign to the trieres are not at all the characteristics of a steamship, they reply that this just shows what odd and mistaken ideas about steamships Greek writers held. We ought rather, according to Collingwood in the autobiography, to understand moral and other concepts in terms of a developing historical sequence. What this might entail, I shall consider later in this chapter. Ayer's critic of intuitionism has quite different roots. In language, truth, and logic, he revived some of Hume's positions, but did so in the context of a logical positivist theory of knowledge. So moral judgments are understood in terms of a threefold classification of judgments: logical, factual, and emotive. In the first class come the truths of logic and mathematics, which are held to be analytic. In the second come the empirically verifiable or falsifiable truths of the sciences and of common sense knowledge of fact. The third class necessarily appears as a residual category, a ragbag to which whatever is not logic or science is consigned. Both ethics and theology find themselves in this category, a fact in itself sufficient to make us suspicious of the classification. For on the face of it, statements about the intentions and deeds of an omnipotent being and judgments about duty or about what is good do not obviously belong together. We can, however, easily detach the emotive theory of moral judgment from this dubious classification. All that we need retain from it is the contrast between the factual and the emotive. In this form, the most powerful exponent of emotivism has been C. L. Stevenson. Stevenson's writing exhibits many influences, above all those of both Moore and Dewey, and his position can perhaps be most easily expounded by returning to Moore. I said earlier that Moore had two kinds of heirs, the first of whom were the intuitionists. What the intuitionists continue is the philosophical appeal to what we all are alike to recognize in moral matters. But Moore himself was, above all, anxious to clear up the philosophical confusions over the concept of goodness so that he could proceed to a second task, that of saying which things are, in fact, good. In his chapter on conduct, he makes it clear that right action is valuable only as a means to what is good. In his chapter on the ideal, Moore tells us what is good. Once the meaning of the question is clearly understood, the answer to it, in its main outlines, appears to be so obvious that it runs the risk of seeming to be a platitude. By far the most valuable things which we know or can imagine are certain states of consciousness which may be roughly described as the pleasures of human intercourse and the enjoyment of beautiful objects. J. M. Keynes has described for us how this view of the supremacy of personal relationships and of the beautiful broke upon the generation immediately younger than Moore with all the force of a revelation. Almost half a century later, Keynes could write, "I see no reason to shift from the fundamental intuitions of Principia Ethica, though they are much too few and too narrow to fit actual experience. That they furnish a justification of experience wholly independent of outside events has become an added comfort, even though one cannot live today secure in the undisturbed individualism which was the extraordinary achievement of the early Edwardian days. It all depended, of course, on who one was and to which social class one belonged. The values which Moore exalts belong to the realm of private rather than public life, and supremely important as they are, they exclude all the values connected with intellectual inquiry and with work. Moore's values are those of a protected leisure, though it is in what he excludes rather than in what he does value that the parochial and class-bound character of his attitudes appears. It is worth commenting on this feature of Moore's views simply to emphasize the fact that they are not, as he apparently supposed, beyond controversy. For Moore combines highly controversial moral views with an appeal to the evidence of simple recognition in order to establish them. Keynes, in the memoir quoted earlier, My Early Beliefs, gives us a penetrating account of the consequent behavior of Moore's disciples. They would compare alternative possible situations and solemnly inquire in which there was most good, inspecting in turn and comparing them. They would then announce what they saw. In an extremely homogeneous group, like that of Moore's immediate disciples, the congruence between what different people see is likely to be fairly high. But the arrival of D.H. Lawrence on the scene, who reacted against the attitudes of this group with all the passion at his disposal, might have made them aware that if challenged on their valuations, their own position allowed them no use for argument, but only for reinspection and reassertion. Since there is in fact no simple, non-natural property which good names, the whole process is merely an elaborate game of bluff. And it would not be unfair to remark that what this group did was to invoke Moore's philosophical theory in order to endow their own expressions of attitude with an authority which those expressions would not otherwise have possessed. But if there is no such property as Moore supposes, then all they can be doing is to express their own feelings. Perhaps in some such reaction to Moore lies one of the seeds of emotivism. Moore himself staked everything on the appeal to objectivity, in an argument which he used in an essay written after Principia Ethica. He contended that moral judgments cannot be reports of our feelings, for if they were, two men who uttered apparently contradictory judgments upon a moral issue would not in fact be disagreeing. A man who said you ought to do X would no more be disagreeing with a man who said you ought not to do X than would someone who said I stacked my hay yesterday be disagreeing with someone else who said, I didn't stack my hay yesterday. To which argument Stevenson's reply was that two men who disagree on a moral question need not be involved in any factual disagreement. They need only be involved in disagreement on the facts of the case. The issue between them at this level can be settled by an empirical inquiry, but they may further disagree in their attitudes, and this disagreement can only be resolved by one party changing his attitude. The primary function of moral words, according to Stevenson, is to redirect the attitudes of others so that they accord more fully with your own. In concentrating on the dynamic function of moral words, Stevenson shows the influence of Dewey, and it is through Stevenson mainly that Dewey influenced later moral philosophers. Moral words are able to have this dynamic function of which Stevenson speaks because they are emotive. The emotive meaning of a word is the tendency of a word arising through the history of its usage to produce, result from, affective responses in people. Ayer, in his version of the emotive theory, concentrated upon my expression of my own feelings and attitudes. Stevenson, in his, concentrates upon my attempt to influence your feelings and attitudes. As to what the key moral words mean, Stevenson offers two models, stressing in each case that the nature of emotive meaning is such that we cannot hope to arrive at more than a rough approximation. His first model is one in which this is good is elucidated as roughly equivalent to I like this, do so as well. In his second model, he attends to those expressions which embody what he names persuasive definitions. Such expressions have a descriptive meaning, and they associate with that meaning an emotive one. We can thus always analyze them in two component elements. Two men in controversy may, for example, use just in such a way that each associates different descriptive meanings with the emotive element in the meaning of that word. Stevens's view of moral expressions lead to a number of other positions. It follows from his view, for example, that for good and for other evaluative expressions, no complete definition in descriptive terms can ever be given. Thus, Stevenson agrees with Moore that good cannot function as the name of a natural, empirically descriptive property. The facts are logically divorced from the evaluations for Stevenson as much as for Moore. Secondly, Stevenson commits himself to the view that philosophical ethics is a morally neutral activity. The doctrines that we hold about the meaning of moral expressions cannot commit us to any particular moral view. Clearly, the emotive theory itself, if true, does appear, at least on the surface, to be morally neutral. For presumably, we can use emotive words to command any class of actions whatsoever. Moreover, if Stevenson is right, evaluative disagreement may always be interminable. There is no limit to the possibilities of disagreement, and there is and can be no set of procedures for the resolution of disagreements. It is not surprising that this should be a consequence of Stevenson's position, since he himself initially laid it down as one of the prerequisites for a successful theory that it should provide for disagreement to be interminable. Finally, on Stevenson's view, the reasons which we cite to support our evaluative, and more specifically our moral judgments, cannot stand in any logical relationship to the conclusions which we derive from them. They can only be psychological reinforcements. It follows that words like because and therefore do not function as they do in other parts of discourse. The difficulties which can be raised about emotivism are of several different kinds. The notion of emotive meaning is itself not clear. What makes certain statements guides to, or directives of, action is not that they have any meaning over and above a factual or descriptive one. It is that their utterance on a specific occasion has import for, or relevance to, the speaker or hearer's interests, desires, or needs. The White House is on fire does not have any more or less meaning when uttered in a news broadcast in London than it does when uttered as a warning to the president in bed. But its function as a guide to action is quite different. Emotivism, that is, does not attend sufficiently to the distinction between the meaning of a statement, which remains constant between different uses, and the variety of uses to which one and the same statement can be put. Of course, meaning and possible range of use are intimately related, but they are not the same. Moreover, not only does Stevenson tend to conflate meaning and use, but the primary use which he assigns to moral expressions is not and cannot be their primary use. For the use to which he attends is the second person use, in which we try to move other people to adopt our own views. Stevenson's examples all picture a thoroughly unpleasant world, in which everyone is always trying to get at everyone else. But in fact, one is only in a position to try to convert others to one's own moral views when one has formed views of one's own. Yet none of those uses of moral language which are necessary to the formation and expression of one's views with an eye to one's own actions figure in Stevenson's initial account. Finally, one can justifiably complain of the emotive theory not only that it is mistaken, but also that it is opaque. For its proponents seek to elucidate moral expressions in terms of the notions of attitudes and feelings, and it is relevant to ask for further characterization of the attitudes and feelings in question. How, for example, are we to identify these attitudes and feelings so that we may distinguish them from other attitudes and feelings? Emotivist writers are, in fact, largely silent on this point, but the suspicion is strong that they would be compelled to characterize the attitudes and feelings under discussion as just those attitudes and feelings which are given their definitive expression in acts of moral judgment. Yet, if this is so, the whole theory is imprisoned in uninformative circularity.